are getting dangerously close to the point of no return. All G20 countries must accelerate their transition now in this decade. Humanity has a choice: cooperate or perish. It is either a climate solidarity pact or a collective suicide pact.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and that is UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres at the COP27 UN Climate Summit in Egypt, going on this week.
In just days, our planet's population will cross a new threshold. The 8 billionth member of our human family will be born. This milestone puts into perspective what this climate conference is all about. How will we answer when baby 8 billion is old enough to ask, "What did you do for our world and for our planet when you had the chance?" We are in the fight of our lives, and we are losing. Greenhouse gas emissions keep growing. Global temperatures keep rising. And our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible.
Well, 5 years ago, science writer David Wallace Wells rang out the same warning. He wrote an article titled "The Uninhabitable Earth," one of the most read in the history of New York Magazine. It became a book. And Wallace Wells started the article with this, quote, "It is, I promise, worse than you think. If your anxiety about global warming is dominated by fears of sea level rise, you are barely scratching the surface of what terrors are possible." In the article, he goes on, quote, "Even when we train our eyes on climate change, we are unable to comprehend its scope. Absent significant adjustment to how billions of humans conduct their lives, parts of the Earth will likely become close to uninhabitable and other parts horrifically inhospitable as soon as the end of this century." End quote. Well, David Wallace Wells is with us now. And David, welcome to the show. You wrote that Uninhabitable Earth article 5 years ago now. Do you feel the same way still? Are we hurtling our way to climate catastrophe and an uninhabitable Earth?
Well, I wouldn't say an uninhabitable Earth. I mean, there are parts of the planet that are already, of course, pretty hard to live in, and probably those will grow over the coming decades. And I do think that that story is a really important one. Things are going to get worse from here. Climate damage is growing. Climate suffering will grow too. And we're not moving nearly fast enough to secure the sort of future that a generation ago we might have hoped for. But there's another story too, and that's the one that I wrote about a few weeks ago. And that's about the worst case scenarios becoming considerably less likely too. So things are getting worse from here, but the distant future doesn't look nearly as grim as it looked 5 years ago. In fact, a lot of the things that we were worrying about then seem almost impossible to imagine today. And I think few people really appreciate or understand that, in part because, you know, the news outside their windows and on their social media feeds is of an ever-intensifying climate crisis. And as I said a minute ago, that story is true. The climate crisis is getting worse. But at the same time, thanks to a number of factors, the world turning away from coal, a global political awakening, leaders in the corporate world and the public sector taking climate change really seriously for the first time, and perhaps most significantly, this incredible technological progress with the price of renewable energy, making it cheaper in almost everywhere in the world than dirty energy. For all these reasons, we now no longer see an emissions trajectory taking us to 4 or 5 degrees Celsius of warming, which is about 3 or 4 times as much as we've seen to this point, but rather somewhere between 2 and 3 degrees of warming. Mm-hmm. And that means that we've basically cut in half our expected temperature rise in just about 5 years. We're still going to shoot past the thresholds that scientists have told us mark the difference between safe and unsafe warming. And we're going to end up quite likely in an area at a temperature level that they describe as dangerous or even catastrophic. But we're much, much less likely to end up in this sort of truly apocalyptic futures that seemed not just plausible, but sort of important to imagine just a few years ago. And I think, given the landscape of things, we have to have a way to see that progress and appreciate it too. Yeah.
Well, so you've written about this new, I'm pausing because I don't really want to call it hope. We'll come we'll come back to that word in a second. But you've written about this new view of what the next several decades might bring in a article in the New York Times magazine. It's called Beyond Catastrophe, A New Climate Reality is Coming into View. And there's also a companion piece called Envisioning Life After Climate Change. And by the way, folks, we have links to both of those at onpointradio.org. So before we get to more of the details, the scientific details, I just want to know, David, how do you feel about this new sort of climate reality versus how you felt 5 years ago after you wrote The Uninhabitable Earth? Do you actually feel a little less wedded to the concept of doom with climate?
Well, you know, I should say I never really thought of myself as a doomer. I mean, there are a few people who probably called me that at the time, but I did call myself an alarmist, and yeah, that's because I was alarmed about what I saw coming, and I'm still alarmed. I think even at 2 degrees of warming, which I think is, you know, maybe not exactly our best case scenario, but sort of a an optimistic future from where we are today. Even at 2 degrees, we're talking about climate disruption unprecedented in the history of humanity, and I don't think we're anywhere near prepared for that. So I remain alarmed. But coming down from a baseline of expecting twice as much or more warming than that, you know, things are looking considerably smoother than they looked to me a few years ago. And that's because the world has actually started taking action here. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, climate activists might say totally defensively, nobody is paying attention. Nobody is doing anything. The world is not acting as though this is an existential threat. It's not even really acting as though it's a threat at all. And those critiques are no longer valid. The world is moving. We're not moving fast enough. We're not decarbonizing fast enough. That's why we're likely to pass these thresholds that scientists have called dangerous or catastrophic in the past. And yet, we're moving quite quickly.
Yeah.
You know, there's been more investment made last year in renewable energy than in dirty energy. I heard yesterday that 90% of the new energy capacity that was added last year was in renewables. We're turning the corner. You know, we're still doing way too much damage. In fact, because we haven't yet reached an emissions peak, we're doing more damage this year than we've ever done in any previous year in the history of humanity. But we now see a near-term future in which we reach a peak and begin to decline. In fact, that's what the International Energy Agency, which tends to be a conservative forecaster, predicted would happen over the next 5 or 7 years just last week.
Yeah.
Now, what that means in terms of how we relate to that future has a lot to do with, or as much to do with, our own personal perspectives on the arc of history and the possibilities of human response and resilience as it does the scientific facts. The scientific facts say we are already outside the window of temperatures that enclose all of human history. Things are going to get considerably worse from here, making the sort of basic assumptions, the basic ecological and climatological assumptions that undergird all of human life, much less tenable in the decades ahead. Whether we can adapt to that and find ways of engineering new ways of living, new forms of human flourishing in that context, on that new landscape, is an open question. Personally, I'm relatively optimistic about that, I think. But again, I'm coming down from a much higher baseline of alarm than most listeners or most people in the world today, who are probably still looking at the climate future and quite reasonably thinking, well, it's going to get a lot darker from here.
Right. Well, you know how I look at it? Because this is ideally what science does. As we gather more and more data, we refine what the scope of possibilities is, you know, and a good maybe analogy is in the earliest days when there's a hurricane on the horizon, and you know, people see those weather maps that have the giant cone of possibilities of where that hurricane could make landfall, but then with each passing hour and passing day, that cone gets, you know, narrower and narrower the more we know. I feel like the same thing is happening with climate. That doesn't mean in both the case of the hurricane and climate that bad things won't happen, right? It's just that maybe we know a little bit more accurately what those things are. But I want to spend some considerable time, David, really hearing in detail the things that have changed in the 5 years that since you wrote Uninhabitable Earth, the first article. For example, you've mentioned a couple of times, but let's talk about this a little bit more. Even just the cost of solar and lithium batteries, the essential units for renewables, you say has gone down precipitously, and that's making it a bigger part of the overall energy picture.
Yeah, since about 2010, the cost of solar power has fallen between 85 and 90%. So a unit of solar power now costs about 10 or 15% what it did in just 2010. There have been similar, if a little bit smaller, declines in the price of onshore and offshore wind, which have fallen between 60 and 80%. And the cost of the cost of battery technology, which is critical to sort of store these this new power, so that, you know, we can't just use solar when the wind blows, or when the sun shines, and wind when the wind blows, we can use it all the time. That cost of battery technology has also fallen by about 80%. And what that means overall is that these technologies, which used to seem like expensive burdens to our economies and our lives, are now actually the preferable alternative, totally putting aside the climate considerations and thinking just in a strict cost-benefit analysis framework. It is now much cheaper to build new renewable capacity than to build new dirty capacity. By some estimates, 90% of the world lives in places where that's the case. And over the next few years or next decade, it'll surely reach 100. At the same time, it'll start to be the case in more places, although it's already the case in some, that it'll be cheaper to build new renewable capacity than even to continue running existing fossil fuel plants. And that means that no matter what perspective you come to this challenge from, this crisis from, if you're a policymaker with some interest in protecting your community from climate impacts, if you want to simply lower the electricity cost,
David, hang on
consumers,
for just a second. We have to take a quick break here. I'll let you finish that thought when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're talking with David Wallace Wells. His recent piece in the New York Times Magazine is called Beyond Catastrophe, A New Climate Reality is Coming into View. And we have a link to it at onpointradio.org. And David, you were talking, I just want to let you finish your thought about why the reduced cost of renewables is an important factor to consider here.
Yeah, it just means anybody who's considering these, making investments in energy and electricity and power generation, from the individual homeowner all the way up to presidents and prime ministers, the logic is really clear that the better investment is renewable power. And that means that we're seeing a lot more of that investment, which means we're seeing a lot more of that build out. It's not the whole challenge. There's, in order to scale this up to the level that we need, we need to dramatically grow the amount of renewable capacity that's being built every year. But we're finally pointing in the right direction after several decades of pointing in the wrong direction.
So let me help me understand clearly that does this mean, first of all, that that there's just this new revised temperature rise of roughly, say around 2 degrees C, which is still a lot. We'll talk about what might happen even at 2 degrees centigrade. But is that because there's just less carbon going into the atmosphere now? Or on what basis are scientists making this renewed assessment? And by the way, who is making, who has said this change has happened?
A number of scientists, I think there have been about, you know, about maybe 6 or 8 or 10 major papers over the last couple of years, making new assessments of our likely energy future and finding that that's the range that we're heading for, and then between 2 and 3 degrees. And then there have been a number of sort of meta-analyses by other groups, you know, including the UN, including Climate Action Tracker, a number of other bodies that do this work independently, all finding, you know, somewhere between 2 and 3 degrees is a likely future. And what they're looking at is actually not what we're doing now. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. we're actually emitting more carbon right now than at any previous year in human history, which means we're doing more damage to the future of the climate in 2022 than at any previous point. It's that the near-term and medium-term future looks really different. And that's true for a number of reasons. One of them we just talked about, the dramatically dropping price of renewables, which means that in a, you know, true free market sense, renewables are now a preferable choice and are likely to grow much faster than seemed likely 5 or 10 years ago. It's also because governments of the world are for the first time implementing genuine and somewhat aggressive climate policies and promises. In some cases, they're making pledges that they haven't yet backed up or sort of instantiated with actual investments in policy. But in many other cases, they're actually putting their money where their mouth is. And that changes the landscape of things too. On top of which, there's been revisions to our expectations for the energy mix of the future based on sort of non-political and not even really market factors, which is to say, we look likely to be doing a lot less burning of coal this century than we did or than most analysts believed we did a decade or 2 decades ago. And in part, that's because we have a much clearer sense of the public health costs, where for every 1,000 people getting electricity from coal in Europe, one of them dies every year. But it's also because, you know, it just was never all that likely to begin with, probably, that the rich countries of the world would come back from renewables to coal over the course of the 21st century, which is what a lot of these energy models predicted not that long ago. So we have changes to renewable prices, which make renewables much more appealing. We have changes in policy and politics, which makes climate action, it's actually embedded into legislation for the first time ever. And we have a sort of cultural and economic turn away from coal. Those are the three main factors that are changing this future. But as I say, it is a change to our understanding of the future rather than a change to our understanding of the present. Mm. At present, we are still doing a lot of damage right now. And in fact, in my piece, I quote from one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, who says, a lot of these far-off targets and our sense of where we're heading in the distant future are much less relevant than the fact that we're continuing to do damage right now. And we need to try to do everything we can to stop doing that damage as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of value in that perspective as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sort of predisposed. My personality is predisposed to actually seek hope when it comes to issues, the biggest issues facing all of us. And at the same time, though, that this reality check is important, David, because, you know, like, for example, in the world of finance, they always say, you know, past results, past returns are never a guarantee of future performance. So it seems as if that this revised estimate of how much mean global temperature will rise, as you said, it's a revision of expectation. So those expectations, humanity could fail to meet those expectations, though, right? I mean, that's still also a possibility.
Well, it depends where in that range you're talking. I mean, that's really where a lot of the range of it comes in. You know, many of these projections say that if absolutely every climate promise or pledge was fulfilled perfectly with no hiccups or road bumps or obstacles along the way, the world could actually expect to see warming this century of only 1.8 degrees, so below 2 degrees. And they say if only the climate policies that are actually built already into law with money behind them are fulfilled, which is to say, you know, no future additional climate policy over the entire rest of the century, except what we already have in place in a very real way today, we could expect something like 2.6 or 2.7 degrees of warming. Is it possible that we could fail further and undo some of the climate policy that we have today? I suppose it's possible, but I think it's much less likely than that we end up somewhere in between those two points where we, you know, hit some road bumps, hit some obstacles. Some things don't work out as well as we could. But in general, the world elevates rather than diminishes its collective climate ambition. And I think you see that, you know, almost at every level, at every, you know, country that you look at, that it just doesn't seem likely that 20 years from now, we're going to be less concerned with climate change than we are today. And that means that climate action, climate policy is likely to be moving in a more aggressive direction rather than a less aggressive direction. That's not to say that victory is inevitable here. In fact, I think, you know, defining victory the way that scientists would have defined it 20 years ago, we've already lost the possibility of real victory. But I think it's much more likely that we elevate our ambitions and intensify our commitment to decarbonization rather than retreat from those commitments. That's not to say that everything's going to go perfectly. And it's not to say that there aren't going to be surprises in the climate system that make even, you know, with a, given a certain level of emissions, make it possible that the warming at that level will be, and the impacts at that level will be more intense than we expect. In fact, scientists are already uncovering that. But I do think it's, you know, we can sort of set a ceiling of expectation at the policies that are today real laws around the world, and basically count on them not getting worse over the next few decades.
I mean, so what you're saying is we can do this.
Well, we can do something. I mean, we can limit global warming to somewhere between 2 and 2.5 degrees without all that much additional action. And that's good news, given that a few years ago we used the phrase business as usual to describe a future of 4 or 5 degrees. But if we hope to stay below 2 degrees, or even limit warming to 1.5 degrees, which is the more ambitious goal of the Paris Agreement and has organized a lot of the global climate ambition of the last 5 years, we're going to have to do a whole lot more, actually, than we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. And I think probably that's beyond our political and social capacities at the moment.
Okay. But even this 2-degree mark, though, you know, it's quite something to hear you say that from your research and reporting that you believe that there are enough scientists out there who believe that we could plausibly hit that. The reason why it's remarkable to my ear is looking back at your 2017 article. There's a section in that article where you say that 2 degrees of warming used to be considered the threshold for a catastrophe, tens of millions of climate refugees unleashed upon an unprepared world. And you said in 2017, now 2 degrees is our goal per the Paris Climate Accords. But experts at that time gave us only slim odds of hitting it. So just to be clear, are you saying that the odds are better now?
Of getting to 2 degrees or below, I think significantly better.
Okay.
And that's for a lot of the reasons we were talking about earlier, that, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it would have been perfectly plausible to look around and say, nobody's doing anything. And it just isn't the case anymore. We're not doing enough. We're not moving fast enough. But we're doing a lot. And what that has done has pulled some of the more optimistic scenarios closer to the realm of plausible or even likely. If we want to stay below 2 degrees, I think that's going to be very hard, and getting all the way to 1.5, probably impossible. But if I had to place my own bet, I would say we're likely to end up sort of just north of 2 degrees this century. And, you know, as I said in that original article, that was beyond the threshold that scientists described as catastrophic. It's still beyond that threshold. And in fact, the science that's been produced in the intervening years suggests it may even be harsher than we thought 2 degrees would be 5 or 10 years ago, because we know more about the impacts and we know how quickly they're coming. Nevertheless, it's a lot less harsh and a lot more manageable than warming of 3 or 4 or 5 degrees would be. And that's where we are. It's not a simple story of climate victory or climate defeat. We can't anchor our sense of the future in a kind of Pollyanna hope of a climate normal. We've left normal behind, but we also don't need to anchor it in visions of apocalypse, which is how many of us have been anchoring our expectations over the last few years. We're going to be in that middle, in that muddle, struggling through and trying to apportion responsibility and protect one another in a transformed landscape that is nevertheless not apocalyptic.
Right. Well, I mean, look, in your 2017 article, you definitely presented multiple apocalyptic scenarios, including the very bracing and unforgettable image of or thought of a human body not being able to tolerate the heat in a Costa Rican jungle by the end of the century, to the point that like we would actually melt essentially. But in your new article, again about this 2-degree mark, you quote a Canadian atmospheric scientist, Catherine Hayhoe, who told you that the good news is that we have implemented policies that are significantly bringing down the projected global average. She also added that we've been, quote, systematically underestimating the rate and magnitude of extremes, as she told you, that even if the temperature rise is limited to 2 degrees, the extremes might be what you have projected for 4 to 5. Now, with that in mind, David, you know, it's so interesting. I think anyone who is in the world of science or who writes about science is very comfortable with the idea of the evolution of knowledge. So while maybe even less comfortable than others might be, but in 2017, a lot of people pushed back on your article saying you were being too alarmist, right? Now, in 2022, there's been some pushback to your new article, the new Beyond Catastrophe article, saying, like, maybe you are being too Pollyanna-ish. And I just want to give some voice to those concerns. We spoke with Brett Hartle. He's Government Affairs Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. He went so far as to call your article deeply morally irresponsible.
The differences between 1 degree of warming and 2 degrees of warming and 3 degrees of warming is, in fact, devastating suffering for billions of people around the world. And he sort of casually writes that off as almost a given, and that we should embrace the fact that I guess it's not worse than that.
I should note, though, that Hartle does not argue with your main point that the Earth's temperature hasn't risen as much as scientists initially feared.
It's true that we are in a better place than we were 5 years ago and 10 years ago, and we are making progress. But the UN, IPCC, and other reports are still saying that most government promises and most government actions are still very inadequate. And so we should celebrate the progress we've made, but I think we shouldn't equivocate or sort of, as the author says, normalize that we're baking in additional warming.
Hartle says that his concerns about that have to do with the fact that governments and industries might pull back on their efforts to reduce carbon emissions.
It's like mission accomplished from back in the day with George Bush. Like, when you give people an excuse to normalize the future of climate change with 2 or 3 degrees Celsius, you take away the urgency. I mean, he's effectively saying, yeah, it won't be as terrible as we thought it would. It'll still be bad, but that's better than being terrible. Well, okay, but we shouldn't give someone an excuse, a government excuse, policymakers an excuse to lose focus.
Hartle agrees with you, though, David, that people do need hope. He says the best way to build hope is to aim high.
You know, it's sort of like going to the moon, right? You set a broad vision and say, we're going to get to the moon. We know it's going to be tricky and difficult, but when you set the vision as aggressively as possible, that does give people hope. It does inspire folks. Can you imagine if the message was, we're going to get to the moon, maybe or not, but half the rockets are going to blow up and other people will suffer? That's not as inspiring a message.
That's Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. Well, David, what's your response to Brett Hartle's critique here?
Well, I have a few different thoughts. I would say, first of all, you know, I wouldn't describe this article as downplaying the impacts of warming. I boil down the sort of thesis at the top of the piece into 3 points. The first is that worst case temperature scenarios now look much less likely. Second, I say, and just as important, the likeliest futures still lie beyond thresholds long thought disastrous, marking a failure of global efforts to limit warming to safe levels. And perhaps more concerning, the more we are learning about even relatively moderate levels of warming, the harsher and harder to navigate they seem. And I quote the United Nations calling a world of more than 2 degrees as being a world full of endless suffering. But you know, my main mission here is not to target a message to mobilize the world. It's to tell the truth about the path that we're on. And while I agree that 2 degrees will be very difficult. I also think that just logically, it's a lot better than 4 or 5 degrees. And it reflects the action that we've undertaken over the last 5 years, all of the climate protests, all of the speeches, all of the policymaking. And as a result, it's encouraging to those who are doing that work, because it's a sign that not all of this is pointless, that it is in fact making a difference. Now, whether continuing to focus on the possibility of 1.5 degrees could motivate or mobilize more action, I think it's certainly true looking back that the urgency produced by that goal, and indeed by a lot of the alarmist climate rhetoric of the last 5 years, has played a significant role in all of this action that is reducing our expectations from 4 or 5 to 2 to 3. On the other hand, at some point, I think we have to be realistic about what is possible and what isn't. Mm-hmm. And according to the UN IPCC climate change body, which is basically the true gold standard of climate science, it's sort of like twice peer-reviewed stuff, because stuff has to get just not just published in the best journals, but then reviewed a second time by the world scientists to be included.
David,
in
we just have to take a quick break, so I'm going to head in that direction and let you finish when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and David Wallace Wells is with us. And David, go ahead and finish your thought.
We were just talking about the question of whether continuing to focus on the goal of 1.5 degrees, which was set in the Paris Accords in response to the demands of vulnerable countries and developing nations, whether that was helpful or not. And I agree that that standard, that threshold, has given us a lot more urgency and helps explain some of the progress we've made over the last 5 years. But I think we also have to, at some point, look at just how plausible that is. And when we look at the UN IPCC report, they say a few quite striking things in this regard. The one that came out earlier this year found that even the emission scenarios that were originally designed to allow us to stay below 1.5 degrees now will take us past it because we've taken so long to take action. And that means that none of the studied scenarios that the IPCC is even considering limit warming permanently to under 1.5 degrees. They also find they have a carbon budget, which is to say an estimate for how much carbon could be produced by the planet to give us a 50% or a 66% chance of staying below 1.5 degrees. And those budgets are expected to be completely exhausted at just 7 years of current emissions. And as I said earlier, we have not yet reached a peak of emissions. So over the next 7 years, we are likely to be dealing with emissions that are higher than today's level, which means that entire goal will pass out of our hands, out of the realm of even theoretical possibility over the course of this decade. Now, given that context, should we continue to focus on that target and continue to talk about it as not just a reach goal, but something that is absolutely necessary to protect humanity? Or should we start thinking about what it would mean to live in a world of 1.8 or 2 or 2.2 degrees with much more climate damage, much more climate suffering, so that we can start to begin adapting, responding to those changes, and allowing human life that is going to be conducted at those temperature levels to be more just, more prosperous, and more full of equity and flourishing? My own view is that the second is much more practical, given how impossibly likely impossibly unlikely it now seems that we stay below 1.5 degrees. Yeah. I do think it's important to do as much as we can to limit temperature rise as much as we can, keep it as low as we can. But I also think that we now know that we are going to be living in a world that climate scientists have long called dangerous. And in addition to focusing on cutting emissions, we need to take seriously that level of warming and start to prepare for life on the other side.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with you on that. Because the even if we just shut down this second all carbon emissions around the world, we have still altered the atmosphere enough that the horse is essentially out of the barn, right? What you're asking is, okay, well, how far are we going to let it gallop away? And I mean, I'm just looking at your article and you say that the climate future looks darker than today. We're acknowledging that, but brighter than many expected not that long ago. There's reason for both buoyant optimism and abject despair. But the point that you're trying to make, and I think it's an important one, is that we still have to prepare for a climate-altered future, and we really need to think carefully about how to do that. So, I mean, to that point, I just want to play a moment again from the COP27 conference going on right now in Egypt. This is Prime Minister Mia Motley of Barbados, a nation that knows very well the impacts of climate change. And she has said that developed nations still need to step up more to their responsibilities for creating the climate crisis in the first place. But she also said that with enough political will, humanity can do amazing things.
We're in the country that built pyramids. We know what it is to remove slavery from our civilization. We know what it is to be able to find a vaccine within 2 years when a pandemic hits us. We know what it is to put a man on the moon, and now we put in a rover on Mars. But the simple political will that is necessary, not just to come here and make promises, but to deliver on them, seems still not to be capable of being produced.
David, how would you respond to that?
I think she's absolutely right. I mean, I think that Mia Motley is one of the great moral leaders of the climate fight at the moment, in particular because she's talking about these issues in the context of global justice in ways that are hard for people in the global north to hear, but really necessary. 800 million people in sub-Saharan Africa don't have electricity. And you know, as a whole, that continent is producing about 1% of global emissions, and China's producing 30% of global emissions. When we look at the flooding in Pakistan that happened this summer, tens of millions of people flooded out of their homes. They're still dealing with public health damage in terms of malaria and dengue from that, in addition to totally wiped out crops. That is a country, Pakistan, that has produced in its entire history only as much carbon as the U.S. produces every single year. There are analogies and comparisons like that to make as long as all day long. The average American refrigerator produces more carbon than the average person in dozens of poor countries in the world. And because historical emissions hang in the air for centuries, maybe even millennia, all of the carbon that allowed us to prosper through industrialization in the US and Europe primarily is still up there doing equal damage to the carbon that's being produced today by developing countries around the world. And we have to know just at a moral level that we are the authors of this crisis. We are not its clearest victims. People in the equatorial parts of the planet are going to suffer most, but they are suffering because of things we have done, not things they have done. And it is incumbent on us, at least, again, at a moral level, to take seriously those damages and try to respond in some way that will limit the damage to those lives. And I think to this point, we've done extremely little of that. We've done very little to support the decarbonization of the developing world. We've done even less to help them adapt to their new futures. I think it's unlikely that that story entirely reverses over the next decade or two. I think that it's almost certainly the case that the poor countries in the world are not going to be happy with the way that the global north has handled this crisis. But I think that we're actually moving in the right direction, thanks in part to the leadership of people like Mia Motley and Mohamed Nasheed, who is the former president of the Maldives, who've been pushing for some of these you know, some of these mechanisms to be built into the global geopolitical structure, we're likely to see more attention being paid, more money being passed around to those who need it most in response to these climate damages. Again, not enough, but at least more than we're doing today, which is, you know, again, it's one of these things you can either call it a failure or a progress. It's probably both.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm still thinking about how many people fervently believe that if we take our focus off of, you know, trying to avoid worst case scenarios, that that provides sort of the political cover to do less, right? To not be as proactive in trying to avert the potential catastrophes of climate change. But at the same time, I think one of the things that your article really raises is we have to also acknowledge that constantly focusing on the doomsday scenario is quite dispiriting to people, right? And that it does help to say, well, you know what? We can both work to reduce carbon emissions and walk and chew gum at the same time, right? And also make the necessary adaptations for the climate change that we know is coming. I mean, it gives us something achievable to aim for. And with that sort of framework in mind, we reached out to Carol Muffett, CEO and president of the Center for International Environmental Law. And he said that your article makes a very important point.
For decades, policymakers, observers, opinion makers in this space have treated the laws of economics and the laws of politics as though they were just as intractable as the laws of physics. But they are not. It's the laws of physics that we can't change. What his article points to is that the laws of economics can change and are changing really dramatically. And it's at precisely those moments we should accelerate the transition, because the physics aren't going to change. And what humans need to survive, to thrive, isn't going to change either, particularly for the billions of people around the world who are going to be most exposed to the impacts of the climate crisis.
So, David, in your article, in your recent article, Beyond Catastrophe, you write that the world might have already harvested, that's your word, harvested much of the obvious low-hanging fruit of adaptation to this new climate reality. Better meteorology, early warning systems, those things have reduced the death toll of recent monsoons in Bangladesh, you point out. I mean, so what are the other things that you think, a couple of examples that are of higher hanging fruit that we need to think about for adaptation?
Well, I live in New York City, where we're now talking seriously about building a series of sea gates to enclose the New York Harbor that will cost tens of billions of dollars. There's a project like that being undertaken off the Texas coast as well, designed by the Army Corps of Engineers. There are also slightly less expensive but still quite complicated projects to do similar work to prevent coastal flooding with restoration of wetlands and mangrove forests. We also need to think about designing new kinds of crops or cultivating new kinds of crops that can thrive more through drought and heat than the ones that we've been using for the last decades or centuries. We need to think about building a lot of cooling infrastructure, not just in the hottest parts of the world, but in almost all of the world's cities where by, you know, in summer, but in the second half of the century, we're going to be having some days that are hot enough to really cause public health crises if we don't take steps now to prepare for them. And those are just a handful of the changes that are needed. The truth is life is going to be disrupted dramatically at almost every level. And that means that our response has to be similarly all-encompassing and total. This is a global infrastructure project to build a new adaptive capacity to allow us to thrive in a new climate future. And that's quite an ambitious, large-scale undertaking in addition to the industrial revolution scale undertaking that we have to complete to decarbonize all of those systems at the same time.
Well, you also talk with climate scientist Michael Oppenheimer, who says we have to go so far as to even just really change the measures by which we judge our successes regarding climate adaptation, because, you know, he points out to you that these extreme weather events, for example, are just coming much more frequently. So we can't say that, oh, we prepared for a hurricane and then recovered from it. It's how fast that preparation and recovery can happen, because the next great storm is on its way. So, you know, I'm thinking about Houston, Texas, that was underwater several years ago from Hurricane Harvey, and it took years, right, for much of Houston to actually recover. Same thing. We just did a show about the ongoing challenges in Puerto Rico that, you know, got hit by a hurricane recently, but was still recovering from Hurricane Maria 5 years ago. So, I mean, just measuring how quickly we can successfully recover is quite a change in humanity's mindset.
Yeah. Michael Oppenheimer was one of the lead authors of a UN report on the oceans that one of its more striking findings was that in many parts of the world, at about 2 degrees of warming, we're going to be seeing flooding events that used to hit once a century hitting every single year. So just to, you know, that means that if we used to have 100 years to recover from these flooding events, we're now going to have 12 months, and in some cases, less than 12 months. And you mentioned Houston. Hurricane Harvey was devastating there, but actually it was only one of five 500-year storms to hit Houston mm-hmm. in 5 years. And, you know, those terms are kind of meaningless in the current climate context, as your listeners, I'm sure, can pick up. But it's useful just to remind us of how far outside our previous experience we really are already. These are storms we used to expect to hit once every 500 years, once every five centuries, which means once in the entire history of the European settlement of the Americas. That's 500 years ago. One storm in all that time. And Houston has been hit by five of them in 5 years, which is literally millennia of extreme weather in half a decade. Now, the city of Houston is not underwater permanently. There are millions of people still living there. And that's an important thing to keep in mind, too. These impacts, no matter how dramatic, are not the whole of our destiny. They're just the landscape on which we will be building our new future. But that landscape is getting much, much messier and much, much more jagged. And what kind of future we build on it is really as important a question we are going to be asking ourselves over the next few decades as the question of how much we can do to limit global warming. Mm. What can we do given that level of warming to make sure that the future that we share on this planet, the billions of us that are living here, is relatively speaking more full of prosperity, more full of justice, more full of human flourishing and human equity? And those are open questions that are more political than scientific ones. And I think that's one of the main themes of my piece, is that in narrowing our range of climate temperatures, we now have to ask ourselves a somewhat harder set of questions about just how we're going to distribute these burdens and responsibilities going forward, a harder set of questions about a new kind of climate politics that goes beyond the simple project of decarbonization and into areas of how we protect the most vulnerable among us from the impacts we know now are inevitable.
Well, and I mean, regarding, we've got about just a minute left to go, David, regarding the most vulnerable. I mean, you spoke with many people in the global South, right, who talked about, when we talk about adaptation, you can't really ask people who face losing their homes year after year to adapt. That's not adaptation. That's still catastrophe for them. So, you know, again, in the last 30 seconds that we have, what's your final thought on that?
Well, one would hope that we can design a much more humane global system of migration that can allow people to move a little bit more freely with much less resistance, racial and otherwise, to that movement. I think we're relatively far from that ideal future, but I'd like to believe that we can make it happen so that those facing catastrophe in their hometowns and their homelands do have other options, and indeed may find those other options in the end more attractive than the lands they're facing, however tragic that exit from their homeland may be.
Mm-hmm. Well, David Wallace Wells, his recent piece in the New York Times Magazine is Beyond Catastrophe, A New Climate Reality is Coming into View. And we have a link to it at onpointradio.org. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.